I'm just going to give the floor to Glenn. Will you welcome him, please?
Thank you. Okay. Now, the announced program had me talking about Christianity as the origin of human rights and Christianity and philanthropy. I'm going to do both of those in one sentence each, because this morning when I woke up on East Coast time, not mountain time, I had a very clear idea of a different talk that I should be giving. And so I'm actually changing the topic. I hope you don't mind. I'm changing the topic to what went wrong and what to do about it. Looking at our culture today, why has the culture gone south as much as it has? And what should we as Christians do in response to that? So that's what I'll actually be talking about, and it'll be two parts. What went wrong is the first half, and then the second half is what to do about it. Now, before I get there, just a couple of quick notes on what was announced that I would do. The entire concept of universal human rights is actually a product of Christianity. It comes from medieval theologians' reflections on the biblical account, particularly of what it means to be made in the image of God. That, combined with the New Testament's teaching that all people are spiritually and morally equal before God, form the foundation for the entire concept of human rights that we have today. That's the short version of the talk that I was going to give on that. In terms of philanthropy, what I will note there is that although there are a lot of religions out there that emphasize a personal responsibility to help the poor, Christianity is the only one that takes that one step further and says we also have a corporate responsibility to do that. So while you have Jews, Muslims, and Hindus, for example, who as a religious obligation will give to various kinds of charitable institutions, philanthropic things, and so on, the first organization in the world that begins to do this systematically on a corporate level is the church. Starting with the church in Acts that's described in Jerusalem, the entire creation of the office of deacon was really originally designed to handle distributions of charity. And from there, you get lay confraternities in the Middle Ages. You have monasteries and churches involved in it. When the Reformation comes, some of the burden of that gets shifted to governments. The invention of larger-scale philanthropic institutions in the 18th century, largely done by Christians, and so on. And Christians continue to be the leaders in these areas. So that was what I was going to talk about on those two. We're not going to do that, however. What we are going to do is... if I can find the clicker. What we are going to do today is we're going to talk about where our culture has come from. What are the elements that have led really to cultural decline in America? Where did they come from? We'll look at this sort of historically and look at the progression, the development of these ideas. Then we'll look at how the church has responded to them. The short answer there is badly, and what to do about it. So that's the overview of this morning. Now, the first place I want to start is with something that is technically referred to as the fact-value distinction. I'll explain what that means in a minute, but I want to back up from that and give you the foundation for it. And the foundation comes from an idea about the nature of reality. It sounds kind of philosophical, but the basic question is, what is real? What is ultimately real? What is the universe made of? And there's a philosophy that develops starting in the 18th century, really coming to flourish in the 19th century, the 1800s, that's known either as materialism or naturalism. And what this says is that the physical world of matter and energy is all that exists. There is nothing in the universe beside matter and energy. Okay. Now, this automatically moves you into the category of atheism. It also leads you to deny the existence of angels and demons and things like that. It is going to have an implicit rejection of the idea of miracles, because the only thing that exists is matter and energy, of course, and everything follows according to natural law, and so on. Now, this is a basic idea that ends up getting... It starts off in the upper levels of intelligentsia, you know, the scientists and things like that. And even though the vast majority of people don't accept it fully, it is something that affects their thinking. And it really does shape the way they look at the world. We'll see how that plays out as we go along. The second word up there is a Latin word, scientia. It's the root word of our word science. And this gives you, the reason why I'm pointing this out is it gives you an indication of what one of the implications of materialism is. Originally, a science, the term science, referred to any area of knowledge. So theology was considered a science. Every bit as much as something like chemistry or biology or any physics, any of those things. Theology was a science. All kinds of things were sciences. A science is defined technically as any field of study that has some kind of methodology attached to it for how you go about doing those studies. In the 19th century, thanks, Dick. In the 19th century, the word science shifts in meaning. It shifts from all of these different things being sciences to only understanding or knowledge about the natural world. Okay, so what we call the natural sciences, the word science gets shrunk down and focused just on that. And the reason it happens is because of materialism. Because, you see, if matter and energy is all that exists, matter and energy is the only thing that can be known. Therefore, the only thing that qualifies as a science is knowledge about the natural world. Okay? So it follows, once you accept the premises on matter and energy being it, you have to reduce the definition of science to what we would call the natural sciences today. And this leads you immediately to the fact-value distinction. What happens here is that you think of the world in, well, some people describe it as two stories. You have your upper story and your lower story. Your lower story of facts is the realm of knowledge. This is the only thing that can qualify as knowledge. And what these are the brute force facts about the natural world, about matter and energy. It's the only thing that qualifies as knowledge. Everything else goes above the line into the category of values. This would be things like aesthetics. What is beauty? Well, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's whatever you happen to think it is. There's no objective thing. It's beauty. It includes things like ethics, right and wrong. Let me ask you a question. Evil. Is evil matter or energy? It's neither. Goodness. Is it matter or energy? It's neither. Therefore, do good and evil exist? No. Because the only thing that exists is matter or energy. So any questions of right and wrong, good or evil, get thrown above the line. It's just a matter of values. Religion, same kind of thing. So all of these things that are not subject, there are more that we could list here, but all these things that are not subject to the scientific method, all these things that are not subject to empirical study, are not considered facts. They're not considered matters of knowledge. They're considered matters of opinion, taste, faith. And yeah, you're welcome to them, but they don't have any grounding in reality. That split between fact and value, between fact and faith, that dividing line is rigid. It is absolutely impermeable. You will get into massive amounts of trouble with people if you try to make an argument that something from above the line is a matter of fact. People will not accept that. They will fight that tooth and nail. Now, increasingly, what's happening is they're allowing things from below the line to sort of cannibalize above the line. But you can't go in the other direction. That line is an absolute barrier. So if you, for example, were to suggest that there is a such thing as objective right and wrong and we should teach right and wrong in the schools, you will be accused of doing what? What's the phrase? You are imposing your values. You're not allowed to do that. This becomes absolutely central to the way we think, and it's rooted ultimately in that first point, that matter and energy is all that exists. Even people who do not accept that proposition, who say, well, yeah, I believe in God, even people who will tell you that still think using the fact-value distinction. It is something that is pretty much inescapable in our culture. It is so deeply embedded. I guarantee that sooner or later, every one of you has it. Okay. Now, this is sort of an aside, but when I try to break this down for my students, I try to get them to sort of recognize what's going on here. And I will ask the question in my classes. I'll say to them, okay, how many of you believe that there is a such thing as absolute truth? Put your hands up. Okay, you're a different room. In my classes, nobody puts their hands up. I'll get at most one person putting their hand up, maybe two. I'll even occasionally have students start laughing at the question because, of course, it's so ridiculous. There is no such thing as absolute truth. This is your common college student. At which point, I always do the same thing. I say to them, I don't believe you. I know you think that's what you think, but I don't believe that that is what you really think. Let's do a hypothetical. We're on a field trip to New York City. Now, from Billings, that would be a little outlandish, but from New Britain, Connecticut, not so bad. Okay. So we're on a field trip to Washington, New York City, and at about 11 o'clock, we take the elevator up, and we're on the observation deck of the Empire State Building. You're looking out over the city, and it looks great and all that kind of thing. At about 11:30, though, you realize you're getting hungry and would like to have lunch. You do remember that when you came in, there was a hot dog stand at the base of the Empire State Building. So you decide you want to get to the hot dog stand. And you want to get there before noon, because you know at noon there's going to be a huge lunch rush. The problem is there are a lot of people standing in line waiting for the elevator down. Now, you have two choices at this point about trying to get to the hot dog stand. You can wait for the elevator and hope you get down there before lunch, if you're really hungry, you know, before the lunch rush, or you can step off the observation platform, which I guarantee will get you to the hot dog stand in time. How many of you take the elevator? Every hand goes up. And I said, why is that? Because you know absolutely that, well, you're not going to be bothered much by the fall. It's this sudden stop at the end that's going to get you. Okay? You all know that that is suicide. You will die if you do that. So talk to me about how you do not believe that there's a such thing as absolute truth. And then they say, oh, you cheated. I didn't think that's what you were talking about. That, you see, is in the world of fact. Gravity is the world of fact. And of course there's absolute truths there. We thought you meant things like morality. And if they don't offer that to me, I tell them that. And they say, am I right? And yeah, you're right. We thought you meant morality. At which point I say, I don't believe you about that either. I have yet to meet a true moral relativist. So, same field trip. You're walking down the street, traffic is whizzing by, it's a real busy time of day, traffic's whizzing by, and you see a little old lady with her arms loaded full of bags and stuff, and she's trying to cross the road. You have three choices. You can do the Boy Scout thing and help the little old lady across the street. Most of them don't recognize that reference, but anyway. Most of the people in this room will. You can make believe you don't see her and ignore her and just walk by, or you can shove her into traffic. Why don't you think number three is a real option? And they usually laugh at it too. Why don't you think number three is a real option? Because you know absolutely that it is the wrong thing to do, so much so that it's unthinkable. You really do believe in right and wrong. What they mean when they say they don't believe in absolute truth or right and wrong is something a little different. They'll sort of give you this one, but they've got limitations on it, and we'll get to what those limitations are in a bit. Okay, so that's the fact-value distinction. It's deeply embedded in the way we think. And by the way, along with this is another word you should know, scientism. Scientism is, in a sense, You know, if materialism, the idea of matter and energy is all that exists, if that's a metaphysical statement, a statement about the nature of reality, scientism is its counterpart in the area of epistemology, which is the area of knowledge. How do we know things? They're both philosophical categories. Metaphysics deals with the ultimate nature of reality. Epistemology deals with knowledge. How do you know things? Is there such thing as truth? Truth? Well, if so, how do you know it? All of those kinds of things are the epistemological questions. Scientism is the epistemological counterpart to materialism. It's the way you know things in a materialistic universe. And what scientism says is that any scientific explanation of any phenomenon that's out there is automatically superior to any non-scientific explanation. In other words, if you can come up with something that is scientific, even if it's really improbable or bizarre, that is automatically superior to a non-scientific explanation. I would argue that evolution is a case in point. There's remarkably little evidence for macroevolution. As a matter of fact, I can tell you definitively that Darwinism, in the sense of what Darwin proposed for how evolution occurs, has been decidedly disproven. I don't know anybody in the world of biology, even evolutionary biology, that accepts Darwin's explanation. If they do, they do it with major qualifications. But an alternative, like, for example, there is some form of intelligence that behind biological organisms. In other words, that they are actually designed. They don't just look like they're designed. That is ruled out of court because it is not something that falls under their definition of science, which is ultimately tied to the idea that matter and energy is all that exists. And no matter how bizarre the convolutions they have to go through to continue to support this idea of undirected evolution, no matter how improbable it looks, it is accepted as truth because it is a scientific explanation, and therefore it is automatically superior to any other choice. That's scientism. Okay. If you are a materialist, if you believe that matter and energy is all that exists, it's almost inevitable that you're going to end up here. Okay. So this is one of the elements, particularly the fact-value distinction, this is one of the elements that is leading us into the situation that we're facing now culturally, frankly, the degree of cultural chaos we've got. This is number one. Number two, I would argue, is Sigmund Freud. Okay. I always believed Freud should have spelled his name with an A rather than an E, but that's a whole different issue. Freud's basic theory says, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, Freud's basic theory says that the thing that drives human behavior is the sex drive. Okay? The problem is society places constraints on our sexual behavior. And because society places constraints on our sexual behavior and we have this sex drive that makes us want things that society tells us are wrong or bad or evil or dirty or what have you, this creates guilt inside us. And we have to deal with these guilt feelings, and we also have to deal with the kind of sexual energy that exists within our body. We've got to find outlets for it. And this is the root both of human creativity on the one hand, but also psychological disorders on the other. Fundamentally, mental illness is caused by dealing with these problems of the guilt feelings that are induced because of society's repression of our sex drive. In a nutshell, that's what Freud argues. Now, Freud's solution for this is psychoanalysis. And the way psychoanalysis works, this is a technical term, it's different from psychology, it is a specific method of trying to deal with mental health issues. The way psychoanalysis works is you get together with your psychiatrist, your analyst. This is sort of your stereotype that all of us are familiar, well, most of us in this room are familiar with, of the guy lying down on the couch talking to the guy taking notes. And he will ask him questions, and it'll start as a conversation. And it takes a long time to do this right, because the psychoanalyst has to build up trust with the person. person gets to know them, or the psychiatrist gets to know them, the person talks. The psychiatrist never judges anything the person says, never says there's anything wrong with them, never challenges them about anything. He's just trying to get them to open up. And eventually, through looking at the person's dreams and things like that, because, okay, one more step with Freud. A lot of what happens is we suppress these guilt feelings. We suppress even our sexual interests. We push them down into our subconscious so that we're not even aware that they're there, but they're still what's driving our behavior. So what Freud wants to do is get to the subconscious level, and he does it through this process of talking. The analyst asks questions. You talk about dreams. Tell me about your mother. You know, all of these kinds of things. And eventually the person gets to the point where these unconscious or subconscious sex drives are starting to come out. He's starting to become aware of them. And as he expresses these to his psychiatrist, who hears them, does not judge him or condemn him, this relieves the person of their guilt. They say, oh, this must not be as terrible as I thought it was because Dr. Freud accepts me. Even with all of this nasty stuff in me, he still accepts me. I don't have to feel guilty about this anymore. The guilt feelings disappear, and this is what cures your mental illness. That's fundamentally Freud's theory. Freud was actually very conservative in his behavior and so on, and he believed that the problem that we have with dealing with sexuality, he believed that the problem was best solved by helping people, giving people relief from their guilt feelings. Okay, and that this was the right way to do it. Now, I'm not advocating Freud, but you have to understand that's where he's coming from. It turns out Freud was very, very influential, not so much in his own life, to some extent then too, but in the decades afterwards, particularly in the decades after World War II, Freud becomes really mainstream in a lot of ways in culture, Freudian psychology. You can't watch many post-war Alfred Hitchcock movies without seeing Freud all over them if you know what to look for. I mean, he's really affecting the culture in major ways. Then the 1960s come along. And what you get in the 60s is the sexual revolution. Now, what the sexual revolution does, in essence, one way of understanding the sexual revolution is to note that what they're doing is they're taking Freud and they are modifying him. They make the argument that really the key to human happiness is sexual self-expression. It's beyond just simply getting rid of mental illness. This is what makes people happy, is being able to have this free sexual expression. So what they're doing, in essence, in the sexual revolution, is they are saying Freud, in essence, is right about the problem, but he's got the wrong solution. The solution is not to help people deal with their guilt feelings. The solution is to get society to drop its constraints on sexual behavior. Because if society isn't repressing your sex drive, then you won't get guilt feelings in the first place, and there'll be nothing you need to worry about. You just can express your sexuality freely. That's really the essence of what the sexual revolution is saying. It is a vision of salvation through sex. This will relieve you of your any kind of mental illness. It will relieve you of your guilt feelings. It will make you happy and all of that sort of thing if you just simply take off the social restraints. It's quite literally salvation through sex. Now, there are a number of things that have to be in place that make this happen, okay, that enable this idea to take off. The first of them is the pill, modern effective contraception, because one of the things about sex is it can have side effects. So you want to avoid the side effects, and you do this by using contraception, most notably the pill, because it was believed for a long time to be the most reliable way of doing this. That is one of the things that enables the sexual revolution to move forward. People underestimate the social impact of the pill, and with it, more generally, modern contraception. A second element is abortion, because no method of contraception is foolproof. And as abortion gets legalized in Roe v. Wade nationally, this eliminates the other the rest of the major complication, major side effect of sexual activity. If your contraception fails, you can always get rid of the baby. Okay. So abortion fits in with contraception as a supporting element within the sexual revolution. The third is divorce. There's an old joke, and this actually apparently happened, where a school kid was writing an essay about the impact of Judaism and Christianity, and he said that one of the things that happened is it replaced polygamy with monotony. That's why divorce is important. Because, you see, if you really are going to have sexual, free sexual expression, what happens if you lose interest in your partner, your spouse, and get interested in somebody else? One of the things you've got to be free to do is dump them. So no-fault divorce, along with other less common things like open marriage, are other things that help support and increase the impact of the sexual revolution in the culture. And this has become so mainstream. The ideas of the sexual revolution have become so mainstream that I will tell you that my students right now in my university use this as a framework for understanding life. There's really little question about it. We have mainstreamed the sexual revolution on all kinds of different levels. It has been institutionalized via the pornography industry, which, by the way, is the largest. There isn't even a second, close second. It is the largest moneymaker on the internet. As a matter of fact, you can take this a step further. If you look at the development of communication technologies, the ones that succeed are the ones that are adopted by the porn industry. So, for example, when back in the days before DVDs, before Blu-rays and all that, when we had video cassettes, Sony came out with a new type of video cassette called Beta. Beta was in every way superior to VHS. The difference is VHS was slightly cheaper. But the Beta system was far, far better in by every measure than VHS. Beta died and VHS continued. The reason? The porn industry used VHS exclusively because it was cheap. Cheaper. You can look at the development of e-commerce. E-commerce does not really take off until it starts becoming a major vehicle for pornography. We live in a sex-drenched and sexually obsessed culture. My students... Well, I'll talk more about this incident later, but just the particular situation later, it'll probably come up. But I have one student who I like a great deal, who likes me. We get along great, and we agree on almost nothing. It's one of the joys of being a college professor. Every once in a while, you have a student who can separate your views from you as a teacher and don't judge you on the basis of what you believe or not. They judge you on the basis of how well you treat them and whether you teach effectively and all that. So this one student... that I have is a woman, and she is currently dating a transgender person who is in the course of transitioning from female to male. Okay. And she's got a blog about this. She writes a blog about all of the things that are involved in this kind of a relationship. And she commented at one point that, you know, a lot of her friends just, you know, don't really understand this. They're supportive and all of that. But they keep asking her questions like, how do you two have sex? So the assumption is, among these students, that if you're dating or you're close to somebody, you're going to have sex with them. That's the underlying assumption. And so the curiosity question that she gets asked, that she says is frankly none of anybody's business, is how do you two have sex? Until they finish the surgery and she's no longer a she, but fully male, at least as far as they're concerned. They're sort of ignoring chromosomes here. How do you deal with that? You know, what do you do with that? See, this is central to the way they see the world, which has got massive implications for how they view marriage and family. We'll get to some of that later. Now, I want to note something here about the evangelical response to the sexual revolution and contrast it with the Catholic Church. Well, let's start with the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church looks at contraception, the pill and all, any other form of contraception, as wrong, as a sin. And the reason they do that is they say, okay, look, God designed sex for certain purposes. Procreation is one of them. That goes all the way back to Genesis 1, remember, reproduce and multiply. Number two, it's designed to bring the husband and wife together. It's the unitive function. It unites them. And there are actually biological mechanisms that are involved in this. It's actually terribly interesting if you haven't looked at it. There are hormonal things and stuff like that that create attachment between people when they have sex for the first time. So there's the Catholics call that the unitive function. That goes back to Genesis as well. It is not good for man to be alone. So there's this issue of companionship or unity there. And sex is also obviously a source of pleasure. Now, to the Catholic Church, they say that an act is properly ordered if it fulfills the purpose for which it was created. So the degree to which you block or eliminate one of those three items is the degree to which sexuality is disordered. If you are using contraception, you are essentially taking sexual activity and depriving it of its primary function, both biologically and in terms of what God tells us in Genesis. Therefore, contraception is wrong. It is perverting, that is to say, it is turning the sex act into something that God did not design it to be. Or it is rejecting part of God's design for it. The evangelical church, and Protestants in general, their reaction is, hey, there's nothing in Scripture about contraception, it's got to be okay. They never think through, frankly. Now, you may or may not agree with the Catholic position on this, but one thing you got to say about the Catholic Church is they think things through. They take the time to really analyze and think about them. And the Catholic Church's conclusion on this, like I said, you may or may not agree, is that it's wrong. The evangelicals rather unthinkingly adopt it and say, fine, there's no problem with this. I'm not saying the evangelicals are wrong there. What I am saying is that they are being very unthoughtful. They are not really thinking through the implications of what is going on here. Abortion. Catholic Church, it is absolutely wrong. From the earliest days of Christianity, abortion was considered a sin. This is something we inherited from Judaism. It's considered a sin in Judaism as well. The earliest letter that we have from a Christian to the Roman emperor talks about abortion and infanticide, another common practice in the Roman Empire. Both of them were very common. And it is saying we as Christians reject these because they are murder. This has been the stand of the church from its earliest days. Abortion comes along and you find a number of very good evangelicals who are still around, who will go nameless, who originally said, yeah, there's nothing wrong with abortion, it's okay. Because they did not think through the implications of what they're saying. Fortunately, we've come to our senses on that one, for the most part. But originally, we were quite, you know, we were good with it. Catholic Church, absolutely not. Then we get to divorce. Now, the history of divorce is a little more complicated. Catholic Church says no divorce ever under any circumstances. They kind of work around this with a process called annulment. The difference between an annulment and a divorce is an annulment says a legitimate marriage never took place in the first place. So therefore, you're not ending a marriage. It was just not a legitimate marriage originally. That, it seems to me, is cheating. Okay. But that's how they do it. That's how they finesse that one. Within the Protestant world, they accepted the idea of divorce right from the start, but only under very strictly limited circumstances. Jesus says that in the case of porneia, usually translated as unfaithfulness, divorce is okay. Anyone who divorces his wife, except on the grounds of porneia, commits adultery. Okay. So adultery, porneia, immorality, is considered a legitimate ground for divorce, not a necessary cause of divorce, but a potential justification for divorce among the early Protestant reformers. And the second, coming out of 1 Corinthians, is abandonment. This comes out of the passage that says if an unmarried man is will, excuse me, if a unbelieving husband agrees to live with his wife, let them stay together, but if he doesn't, then she's not bound. Okay. So abandonment is also considered potential grounds for divorce. Nothing else, just those two. And even under those two circumstances, it was very, very hard to prove it. Abandonment required 7 years of no contact. Okay, in Geneva. Okay. So within the Protestant world, they accept the possibility of divorce only under certain carefully designated scriptural grounds, and it becomes very difficult from that point on. It is possible to get a divorce, but it's very, very difficult. Then you get the divorce revolution in America, where they say, well, you know, it's not just divorce or abandonment, or even let's add abuse, physical abuse, mental abuse, whatever. That's not a scriptural grounds for divorce, but let's add it. Let's throw that in. But we'll add another one too, irreconcilable differences. We just simply don't get along anymore. I'm not happy with him. Those kinds of things. And at that point, you get effectively no-fault divorce. The couple decides they're going to divorce. Either one of them can initiate it or it can be mutual, and the marriage ends. Now, evangelicals have generally said divorce is a bad thing, but I would suggest that if you actually look at the way we treat divorce, we don't think it's a big deal. We have divorced people are divorced and remarried. By the way, divorce is not a problem itself per se in Scripture. It's remarriage, because it's remarriage that introduces the issue of adultery. Okay. There's actually, if you read 1 Corinthians carefully, there's grounds for separation. They say it's not ideal, but if necessary, it can happen. You can separate, but you are not free to remarry. It's divorce with remarriage that is the issue scripturally. Again, if you have any questions about that, go back and read the passages. We treat divorce with remarriage as no big deal. Yeah, maybe it's an unfortunate thing, but we never talk about it. Divorced and remarried people are certainly welcome to church membership. They're welcome to leadership in churches and all that sort of thing. We act like divorce is nothing. We don't even talk about it in terms of sin anymore. And we don't even question whether or not it is or is not appropriate, particularly the remarriage issue. People do it, that's just fine, it's whatever they want. At that point, we are explicitly violating what Jesus teaches about marriage. And I would argue that it is our easy acceptance of divorce, even within the evangelical churches, that creates the context that allows same-sex marriage. Think about it like this. I woke up at 4 in the morning and I put these notes together this morning. This is not a presentation I've done before. And this is something I should have put in but didn't think of at the time. In Scripture, marriage has a number of specific characteristics. It is between a man and a woman, always. And by the way, Jesus affirms this. When they ask him about divorce, he says, have you not ever read in Scripture that God created the male and female? He starts with that and then talks about them becoming not two but one, and what God has put together, let not men separate. But he starts with the definition of marriage starting as male and female. So even Jesus sees that. Of course, every other culture in the world has. You know, the first same-sex marriage in history occurred 15 years ago. This is even in cultures that accepted homosexuality, they didn't do marriage. Because marriage is for something else. Marriage is not just about sex. Marriage is about children. Marriage exists fundamentally to connect the husband and wife to each other and to their children, to provide a stable environment, to bring the next generation into the world, and to acculturate them. That's what marriage is for. Without marriage, societies collapse because there is no way of bringing children into the world in a stable situation. That is why every culture in the world throughout human history has had a marriage and has given it a privileged place, because the survival of the society depends on marriage, because it depends on providing a stable way for the next generation to be brought into the world and taken care of. That's the anthropological function of marriage, and that is why marriage is given a privileged position. Now, people will say, well, what about couples who are too old to have children or are infertile or something like that? The simple answer to that is legs are made for walking. Just because someone is old and has lost strength in their legs and can't walk doesn't alter that fact. Or if someone is injured, paraplegic, that doesn't alter the fact that that's what legs are for. You don't amputate the legs just because they can't use them, or even just simply because they don't want to use them. The function of legs is walking. The function of marriage is procreation in the next generation. Just because some people don't or can't doesn't change that. That's the fundamental reality. Okay? And that's scriptural. Remember, the creation mandate, the cultural mandate, begins with reproduce and multiply and fill the earth. Okay? So procreation is part of what goes with marriage. There's also the unitive function that I talked about before. It is not good for man to be alone. I'm going to create a helper suitable for him. There's also the idea of permanence. What God has joined together, let not man separate. Those are three critical scriptural elements. Oh, and by the way, let's add sex in there. They become one flesh. Okay, those are those four critical elements of a biblical understanding of marriage. What have we done in our society? We have separated sex from procreation. Okay, we have created a culture with contraception and things like that so that we can, and then abortion if all else fails, so that sexual relations don't have to have any connection at all to procreation. We've also done it the other way around, procreation without sex. This is in vitro fertilization. So those connections have been shattered. We have separated sex from marriage. Think about my college students. We have separated marriage from childbirth. Something like 50% of children in America today are born out of wedlock. So there's no connection there anymore either. We have also broken the idea of marriage as being permanent with the divorce rate. Again, approximately 50%. So what we have done is effectively have shattered every connection that exists in the biblical understanding of marriage within the culture. And by and large, the evangelical church has, for the most part, sat back and acquiesced to all of this. The only thing that is then left for marriage is this idea of companionship, relationship, the unitive factor. So what marriage then becomes is a way of saying, this is my preferred sex partner. And if that is the case, if that's all marriage is, why not have same-sex marriage? That's how we got here on that issue. It's because of the effects of the sexual revolution and, frankly, the church's acquiescence to a lot of these. We lost the battle, frankly, at divorce. Then you get to the political side of things, what I refer to as ideological postmodernism. This is my terminology. Postmodernism is a very large and diverse movement, and it is, for people who study it, they will all tell you it's impossible to define it. I'm not going to try to define postmodernism as a whole. What I'm going to focus on is one particular version of postmodernism that is especially important and that is affecting your lives right now while you're sitting here, and that is this ideological version of postmodernism. Now, postmodernism itself comes about as a result of a radical critique of the modern world and of Western civilization, frankly, in the wake of the world wars. You know, there's all of this hope with scientism, with materialism, all the things we talked about before. There's this hope of progress occurring, that we're going to get better and better, we're going to become more technologically savvy, we're going to be able to solve all kinds of human problems. The world's getting better and better, and we're leading it, according to the Western world. And then you get to World War I, where you're getting battles where people are being killed on a massive scale. 1 million people lost in one battle at the Somme, those kinds of things. In the wake of World War I, you get a lot of people saying, you know, maybe Western Civ isn't the best way of going. Maybe we went wrong somewhere along the way. And then you get to World War II. And in World War II, you add to the incredible level of industrial scale carnage on the battlefield, you get industrial murder. The thing about the Holocaust that really sets it apart from other genocides is all the other genocides out there However systematic they are done using sort of traditional means of killing. You starve people, or you shoot them, or you hang them, or something like that. The Holocaust takes all of the techniques and the skills and so on that are developed in the modern world, factory, mass production, and things like that, and they turn it into a vehicle for murder. Murder is turned into a factory product, done on a mass scale, using science and everything else to find the most efficient way of doing this. It is taking all of the things that the modern world and the industrial world stand for, and it's twisting them around and using them to kill. That's the thing that is so disturbing on a visceral level about the Holocaust. Stalin killed far more people than Hitler did. Mao killed far more than Stalin did. But we don't react to those in the same way, because there's something about the Nazi efficiency and using the tools of modernity to get it done that we just find really disturbing, because it shakes to the core our own belief in progress, our own belief in the goodness of industry and mass production and all the benefits that that brings to the world. Okay, really seriously disturbing. So in the wake of this, there are a lot of people who move on to an increasingly radicalized way of critiquing Western civilization. Now, this has a couple of different parts. The first of them is this idea that pretty much everything that you run into is what they call a social construct. That is to say, our values, our way of looking at the world, some people even go so far as to say science and math, but certainly whatever we regard as truth is something that's simply dictated to us by our society. It has no real reality to it. It is just simply something our society tells us. And we accept it because we grew up in this society. There's nothing that is fundamentally true in an absolute sense. It's only true within its own social context, and it's got no objective reality to it at all. Everything is a social construct. This gets extended ultimately to the idea that even gender is a social construct. Now, originally, what that meant, when you talk about gender as a social construct, what they originally meant by that is you have the biological categories of male and female. Those are facts. Those are real. But different societies have different visions of what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman. And when they use, gender originally was used synonymously with sex, but then when they distinguish between gender and sex, it is on the basis of that issue. What are the role expectations of men? What are the stereotypes? What are men supposed to be like? What are women supposed to be like in this culture? That gets described as gender. And in that sense, gender is a cultural construct. Different cultures have different expectations for men and women. And if you're going to use the word that way, it's perfectly fine. But then they take it the next step and say that even the concept of gender, even the concept of men and women, is itself a social construct. It is unconnected to biology. That's ultimately where we end up with this concept. That's going to have some serious consequences, which we'll see in a minute. So that's the first thing. Pretty much everything is a social construct. The second thing about the specifically ideological version of postmodernism that I'm looking at here is the concept of the zero-sum game. A zero-sum game is a game where if one person wins, another person must lose. If one person gets points, another person has to lose points. There's always an equilibrium. Everything always balances out. If one person goes up, another person has to go down. It's as simple as that. That's what a zero-sum game is. The postmodernists look at everything as a zero-sum game. Everything. Now, most notably, we see this most obviously, I guess, in the realm of economics. So you see, for example, people railing against the 1%. And they argue that because these people are so wealthy, everybody else is poor. Because, you see, the only way they can become wealthy is if they're pushing down everybody else, because it's got to balance out. It's a zero-sum game. Now, this is simply bad economics. You know, this is the old idea of the economy is a pie and you can only cut it into so many pieces, and if one person takes a big piece, everybody else has to have smaller pieces. The problem is, you can open a bakery. There's not just one pie. That's basic economics. But you see, these guys don't bother with that. So that's this entire class warfare thing. If some people are rich, they've got to be rich because other people are poor. Okay. A second part of this is The second area where it's applied is in the idea of virtue. Now, virtue is kind of an old-fashioned word, but I don't know what else to use for it here. Basically, if one person... All right, this is sort of a reverse, rather than thinking of rising and falling. Oppression is bad. Okay, oppression is one of the few things that they would define as being wrong all the time. So if you oppress someone, you lose virtue by the fact that you are an oppressor. You lose virtue. If you lose virtue, what happens to the oppressed? They gain virtue, right? Because it's a zero-sum game. Virtue is a zero-sum game, too. If you're an oppressor, you lose virtue. The oppressed, therefore, gain virtue. What this means is that victims of crimes, victims of police brutality, whatever, get moral authority. And oppressed groups gain moral authority. Because by virtue of being oppressed, they gain virtue because the oppressor loses it. It's a zero-sum game. So this is why you have so many different groups in society clamoring for the idea of victimhood. They want to claim to be victims, because if they claim to be victims, they gain moral authority. It also creates a situation where you get some rather bizarre alliances forming. Thus, for example, men are automatically viewed as being oppressors of women. Therefore, men lose virtue, women gain virtue. And if you don't believe me, look at the depiction of men on commercials. Or most television shows. Watch the commercials, though. They're really interesting on this point. And imagine the commercial with the gender roles reversed. You'd be incensed. Okay? But somehow you can get away with it with men, because men have lost virtue, so they deserve it. Okay? It also applies to cultures. So Western civilization is really at the pinnacle in the world. Western civilization really dominates world culture. How did Western civilization rise to dominate world culture? They did it, they had to do it, by oppressing other cultures. So what that means is, in the inversion, Western civilization now is the oppressor, loses virtue, and non-Western civilizations gain virtue. Thus, for example, the Muslim world has been oppressed and held down by the Western world. By definition, it had to be, otherwise the West wouldn't dominate them. Therefore, the Muslim world has virtue that the Western world does not. Therefore, you will find liberals who are very supportive of, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood, a radical group in Egypt that, among other things, oppresses women. And you will find people who are feminists, ardent feminists in America, who support the Muslim Brotherhood. Even though it's logically incoherent, it makes no sense because they do oppress women there, but because they are non-Western, they're automatically virtuous. They are an oppressed people, therefore they are good. Women are oppressed, therefore they are good. Therefore, women in the Muslim Brotherhood can work together. Except, of course, if the Muslim Brotherhood took over, they'd kill all the feminists. But this is why the alliance forms. It's because of the zero-sum game. If you understand how this works, it makes sense of American politics. Because there's a lot of stuff in American politics that make absolutely zero sense. This is why. It is because of this concept of the zero-sum game in ideological postmodernism. Ideological postmodernism dominates much of American politics, especially, frankly, the Obama administration. Okay, and if you want to understand why they're doing what they're doing, you need to understand this concept of the zero-sum game. Now, to take this further, evil is oppression, it creates these odd alliances. Evil also consists, the other thing that is evil is restricting people's freedom. You do not have the right to restrict anybody else's freedom. What that means in practice is their sexual freedom. People have a right to their independence. They have the right to make their own choices. They want unlimited freedom. And any attempt to restrict that freedom is therefore evil. It is, in fact, a form of oppression. In practice, what they mean when they say they want unrestricted freedom is unrestricted sexual freedom, because they're children of the sexual revolution. In practice, that's really what they mean. So the solution, ultimately, is all of these problems that we see and everything else in society, it's all social constructs. There's no fundamental reality underlying any of these things. Everything is a social construct. So if you want to solve the problem, you have to control society. If you control society, you can eliminate oppression and restrictions on individual freedom. So the goal is to control society. You do this two ways. You do it through gaining political power by whatever means you have to, because since truth is a cultural construct itself, you can lie your way there if you want to. You can literally say one thing to one group and another thing to another group, because really the ends justify the means, because truth itself is an irrelevant category. And secondly, you do it through control of language. Now this one is a little more subtle, but there is a theory in linguistics called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. Don't worry about it. What it says is that language shapes thought, not the other way around. So your language, the vocabulary that you have, even down to the grammatical constructions of a language, dictate how you are going to think. You always think in your language. A simple example, how many of you speak any other languages other than English? Even moderately? Not many of you. Okay, those of you who do, I've got a challenge for you. Try to do math in your other language. You'll find you can't do it. You will always shift back to English. You think in English. You think in whatever your native language is. I would argue for people who are polyglots and who maybe are bilingual, I would argue that their real native language is the language they do math in. But be that as it may, language shapes thought, not the other way around. What this means then is that if you want to control society, you control language. You dictate what people can and cannot say. Because if you limit their vocabulary, you limit the kinds of things they are allowed to express, you limit what they can think. Thus, for example, when I was growing up, a legitimate term for African Americans was Negroes. That was a perfectly legitimate word. As a matter of fact, to this day, we have the United Negro College Fund. Colored people was acceptable too. But, and to this day, you have the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. They never tell you what it stands for, they only use the abbreviation. Someone got the idea that the term Negro was prejudicial, the term colored people was prejudicial, so we had to eliminate those words from our vocabulary if we wanted to eliminate racism in America. So the solution is, let's change it to black. But then you get people objecting, like Duke Ellington famously wrote a piece called Black, Brown, and Beige, which are the colors of African-American skins. And they're not all black, so calling them black isn't really right either. So then they were going to call them Afro-Americans. And then they decided Afro-Americans wasn't good enough, so they switched it to African-Americans. Now black, I think, is coming back, but I'm not absolutely sure. But you see, all of these vocabulary changes, the reason why they are there. Now, I am not in favor of racism. Don't get me wrong here. But they thought that by controlling the vocabulary, by controlling the language, they could create a neutral enough vocabulary that it would eliminate racism from people's minds. It was an attempt at thought control. The entire PC movement, all the stuff about political correctness, that whole thing is an attempt at thought control by control of language. That's what it is. It's as simple as that. It's based on the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, and it's based on the idea that reality itself is a social construct. So if you can control language, you can control society, you control society, you control truth and everything else in it. That's the premise behind it. And you may not think of it that way, and a lot of the sort of amateur people around you who have adopted this stuff may not understand that that's what's going on, but that's what it's about. This is the thinking behind it. The grand bargain that ideological postmodernism is built around is the idea that there's going to be unlimited sexual freedom enforced by government regulation. Unlimited, think about that, unlimited freedom enforced by government regulation. Truth is not only a cultural construct, it appears that contradictions are too. Okay, how does this work in practice? The deal that they are cutting in reality, what you see on the ground today, the deal that is being cut, is that what they mean by unlimited freedom is really unlimited sexual freedom. You give me sexual freedom. You let me have completely free, perfectly open sexual expression. Let me pick my own gender. If I decide I am transgender and I happen to be imprisoned, you supply the sex change surgery. It's going on. You do all of these things. You give me that kind of unlimited sexual self-expression, and I will let you restrict any other freedom you want in order to guarantee me that. That is the grand bargain. That is what is driving a lot of our domestic policies and politics today. And by June, when the Supreme Court rules on same-sex marriage, this is going to be enshrined into law. I'm predicting they're going to rule in favor. Any other freedom has to be sacrificed at the altar of sexual self-expression. This is where all of these things that we're talking about come together, except one, and you'll see that in a second. The impact of this functionally is that what we are seeing emerging is a new worldview, a new way of understanding the very basics of what the world is and how we fit into it. We've got a new definition of what it means to be human. Historically, everybody understood that being human meant that you are male or female, among other things. Now, if you go to Facebook, there are what, 56 different gender choices on Facebook? Now you, I mean, the cutting edge, according to some people, the cutting edge of the civil rights movement right now is pronouns. So you will get high school students, who will tell you, my name is John and my preferred pronouns are. And then they list what pronouns they want you to use to refer to them. And by the way, it could be he, him, his, or Fred could say she, her, hers, or they can completely make up nonsensical terms, and those are the pronouns that you're going to use. Zim, zip, zap. Those are my preferred pronouns, because I don't want to identify as either male or female. Maybe I'm both, maybe I'm neither, maybe I'm fluid. I move from one to the other depending on my mood. High school, this is taking place. There was a report on NPR I heard about a year ago where they were talking about this as the cutting edge of civil rights. This is a total new definition of what it means to be human. It is changing the very foundation of what it means to be human. It is also, of necessity, changing the definition of family. And here's a hint for you. When you change the definition of family, when it is no longer the idea of a father and a mother together with their children and maybe other generations as well, once you move off of that, you are changing the foundational unit of society, the building block around which the rest of society comes. And when you do that, it does and will inevitably have ripple effects on every other relationship and every other power dynamic and every other structure in that society. I have no idea where this goes. And the reason I have no idea where this goes is that this is an unprecedented experiment in human history. Again, even in societies that accepted and celebrated homosexuality, there has never been same-sex marriage, because it violates, even by their understanding of it, it violates the very fundamental idea of what marriage is. We have effectively eliminated the category of marriage from our society. We still use the word, but it has a totally different meaning. The institution of marriage, as it has always existed anthropologically and sociologically, is on life support in the U.S., and once the Supreme Court rules, it's going to be gone. This is, again, unprecedented in human history, and there is no way to predict, as a result, there's no way to predict the consequences. I'm good at guessing things. I can't even guess what the implications of this are going to be. This is going to be massive, and unfortunately, it will probably take a couple of generations before we even begin to understand what the consequences are. I'm guessing it will take at least two generations. My bet is it's going to be no good. The other implication, though, that's really interesting about this, that's a sign of a massive worldview shift, is that the entire idea, particularly of transgender stuff, erodes the fact-value distinction. Track with me here. Remember, the only reality is matter and energy, and the only thing that qualifies as facts is the sort of brute force stuff that's observable and empirical. Anything that isn't is in this upper story of values. Transgender turns this on its head. It says, I am a woman trapped in a man's body. Therefore, I should be treated as a woman. The fact does not matter. It's my internal subjective opinion, my personal ideas and values and what I subjectively experience, that's real reality. The biological facts aren't. So in a very real sense, this whole transgender thing is taking this fact-value distinction and turning it over. It's overturning that. And that, in turn, is also going to have massive ripple effects through the society in ways that are completely unpredictable. Fundamentally, though, the argument is my subjective reality trumps objective reality. My self-concept, my values, are more real than the biological facts of my organism. And again, that's going to have, there's no way of predicting where that goes. Okay, so that's where we are, and that's how we got here. These are some of the key worldview concepts and how they fit together and what they're doing to each other, and something about the interaction. I've already talked a little bit about the church's failures in addressing this along the way. Right now, I think it's time for a break, so we'll take a break and we'll come back and talk about how we as Christians ought to respond to these very large changes in our society. Thank you.
Wait a second.